let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with 1 year or more of sobriety, tells his or her story.
And this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in our personal stories, describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And Eve S. has summoned all her courage and was the second person here tonight, and she is ripped and ready to go. And so glad that so many of you here to support and share the moment with her.
So I'm Eve, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July the 6th of 2008. I was born in February of 1964, right here in Atlanta at Georgia Baptist Hospital. And one of my mother's slogans about me is that Eve came into this world screaming, and she hasn't stopped yet. So that kind of sets the stage. But I was born into a happy middle-class family. I had two parents who are still married today and are deeply in love. I have a sister who's 4 years younger than I am. But we just had a precious little family. I mean, you know, back in the day, we ate all our meals together, and we went to church. Mom and Dad, or Mom anyway, was involved in PTA, and we did everything together. And I was happy as a child. Both of my parents were alcoholics, they're in recovery. But I did not notice any drinking until I was in high school. I just wasn't aware of it. I think one thing that's significant that I want to draw in is my parents' experience with their own parents. It's noteworthy to say that my paternal grandmother and my paternal grandfather were alcoholics. And my maternal grandfather was an alcoholic. And that's just three out of the tree. The tree roots run deeply, or branches run deeply, but those three. And my mother's most traumatic and memory of her life, and it haunts her to this day, is of my grandmother backing the car out of the driveway in Mobile with her and Louise, her mom's sister, my aunt, in the back seat, and granddaddy standing in the driveway crying, begging grandmother not to leave. But you see, he had blown his last chance not to drink. And grandmother ended up actually divorcing him. I think it was around 1947. But that memory that mother has of grandmother backing up and granddaddy crying in the driveway has stayed with her to this day, and it's just really affected her life. He was a military man and a very successful salesman until alcohol took him down. And he was, I believe, in what I call a park drunk. I think there were times when he actually didn't have a home, and he would come and beg my mother for money. So that's one part of the story. And then with Daddy, his father died of cirrhosis of the liver before Daddy was even 10 years old. And Dad can remember being at a presentation in the auditorium and seeing someone come in to get a student, and he just knew it was going to be he. And sure enough, it was. And when they got into the office and he saw Uncle Marvin, my granddaddy's brother, standing there, he knew they were going to tell him granddaddy had died. And he cried and cried and cried, he said. So the one thing I meant to say about my mother is with all of the heartache that she had with her father, the one thing she said is, I will never become an alcoholic. And despite what she went through and what Dad went through, they both did become alcoholics, and then they married one another. aside from my parents, there are two very key figures in my life, and I don't touch on them a whole lot in this story, but suffice it to say they were my world. I'm tearing up now even talking about them. But they were my grandmother and Louise, and this is Mom's mother and Mom's sister. They were just provided for my sister and me materially and emotionally. Didn't matter what we needed, they were always there. Louise was one of these people who was cool. Just, she was cool. She was hip. She was genuine. She was funny. She was actually just hilarious. And you were just drawn to her. Everyone loved her. And she, by the way, she and my grandmother lived together in later years. So this kind of sets the stage. Grandmother's nickname was Mary Sunshine, because she just spread love and sunshine everywhere she went. Her other nickname was Big Mary, because she ruled the roost. She was Mary Gardner Youngblood. But she was full of love and generosity and goodness. I think she was probably what you would call that perfect little lady. But they were definitely my sisters and my support system. So they're always in my heart and in my story. In terms of my childhood, in kindergarten and first grade, I got in trouble a lot for talking. I spent kindergarten in the thinking chair. And I spent first grade standing in the corner looking out at Togo Hill Shopping Center. If any of y'all know where that is, I went to W.D. Thompson Elementary, which was ripped down in 72. But I got in trouble for talking a lot. I remember that deep feeling of fear and insecurity that was with me even as a young child. I would not spend the night away from home until I was either 13 or 14 years old. I loved my family. I loved my mother. Most of all, I was very attached to my mother. And so you couldn't get me to spend the night away from home. That's deep insecurity. Second grade was my best school year ever. This includes everything in college. I had the greatest teacher. She beats any prof I ever had. She was kind, loving, and caring, and firm. And I'm talking about her because she was just what I needed in my life. Kind of like grandmother and Louise. And at the end of second grade, not only did I lose her because I was going to a new grade, but that school closed. So, and this is a theme that kind of resounds in my story that I did not deal well with transition. So the school closed, and I had to go to a new school with new students. I began riding the bus instead of walking to school, and I could not handle it. Something happened to me, and I got very, very sick. I missed at least 6 weeks of school, and I can still remember how ill I felt. And these were things, I would have nosebleeds. I would faint. Mom and Dad took me to every specialist probably that there was in Atlanta, trying to get to the bottom of what was wrong with me. And no one ever did. But eventually I got back on my feet, got back in school, and I did fine. I always had a lot of friends. I always made good grades. And in that younger part of school, you know, I did piano and ballet, and I was a Brownie Scout. I was very involved. So the transition into high school was fine. I continued with the to make excellent grades, and I made new friends. I did cheerleading. I did drill team. I was the president of the Kappa Club, and I was in the Beta Club. I mean, did it all, right? I hung around in the cool crowd, but I never felt cool. All of my girlfriends were beautiful. I mean, they were stunning, and they dated really cool guys, and I never felt that I measured up. And in 1979, when I was 15, I had my first drink. So my parents had gone out for the evening, and I just was dying to know what it felt like to have alcohol in your system. So I went to where they, Mom and Dad, kept their liquor, and I got a blender and an alcohol recipe book, and I made several concoctions that night, and I could not tell you what they were now, but I remember going outside and walking up and down our driveway just so I could get a sense of what it felt like to walk with alcohol in your system and just to be alive with alcohol. So the next thing you know, I pass out, right? The next thing after that, I wake up, Mom and Dad are home, and I'm vomiting everything I have eaten and drunk that night. I did not tell them about the alcohol, nor did they figure it out. I think I finally told them years later. But despite that first harrowing experience with alcohol, that was probably the same year that I started drinking with my friends. We would get together on weekends, and some of us could drive. My friend Pam turned 16 several months before the rest of us. Anyway, we had people who would drive us. We went to parties, and we went to people's houses, and we drank. Nothing significant. It just was a mere fact that we did some drinking on the weekends. One hint of my addiction to come is that around age 16 to 17, I became anorexic. Not the bulimic where you grow up, but the anorexia where you control food. And I controlled it so much that I probably weighed 90 pounds at my short little height. I was tiny. So I'm going to fast forward to 1982. I was 18, senior in high school. And I began measuring the alcohol that my mom drank every day. I started figuring out what was going on. And I literally got a ruler and would measure her liquor bottles. And then I would call grandmother and each day and say how many inches mother had drunk. And grandmother was not impressed at all. And especially after everything she had dealt with her husband. So she got mother in AA. Didn't take much convincing. And mom got it right away. And what's so ironic to me about it is that right as mother's drinking career ended, mine was about to really take off. The other thing that happened, the reason that I was so frustrated with mother's drinking was we had these relatives, Mimi and Johnny, and these are all relatives on dad's side of the family. And they had these dreadful parties every 4th of July and every Thanksgiving with 30 or 40 of the Roberts, dad's family there, 30 or 40 people, and everybody would get smashed. So the 4th of July thing was a pool party, and they had two houses there. They had a pool house. They had all this stuff. But I just remember my parents tripping and slurring. I remember my Uncle Curtis vomiting. I remember people being so drunk, and I was just livid. You know, I could have been anywhere from 13 to 16. And I remember at one of these pool parties, Dad's sister said, "Good God, just give Eve a drink. Maybe that'll help her relax." And I was not happy with that comment. And then it seems like there was one more thing when we were 13 at the Thanksgiving party, they had wine at our places, the children's places, to drink. They just expected us to drink, and I did not. So you have this mix of my sort of experimenting with alcohol and then being horrified at it. The end of high school, so this is 82, this is my senior year, was very scary for me. Again, this is another transition that I did not handle well. I didn't want high school to end. I loved it, and I didn't want to leave my friends, and I certainly didn't want to go away to college. I was always bound to home, and I went to UGA. In fact, Dad used to joke that Eve is the only person I know who has season tickets when Herschel Walker is the star, whatever he was, that and even though she's got senior free season tickets, she's driving home on a Saturday afternoon to do her laundry instead of go to the ball game. So that's me, just coming on home. But I did get lost at UGA. It was way too big for me. My graduating class at Briarcliff had 100 people in it, and it had everybody I'd gone to kindergarten and elementary school with. And then here I am at UGA sitting in classes and theaters with 400 people, and I'm terrified. The other thing that happened was Daddy took me to school. I think Mother was teaching. And I didn't have a roommate. I chose to take potluck. I didn't have anybody to go with. And the roommate and I were totally incompatible. It was horrible. It was depressing. It took me several weeks to finally find another situation. But all of that was just dreadful. So I got a new roommate. There were two fun, cool girls across the hall from us and two fun girls next door to them. And that's when the fun began. So I drank. I remember I went to frat parties and did all the drinking and carrying on that probably normal college people do. But that third quarter spring in the University of Georgia is like nothing I've ever seen in my life. And I only had two classes that quarter, back in the day that we had quarters. And my classes ended at 11 o'clock, and so all I did was lie out in the sun all day and drink Coca-Cola and eat Snickers bars, and I'm sure we went out and drank at night. That partying and the drinking carried into that summer. And I think about it, and it's such a shame that I drank to the extent that I did, because I met the nicest people. I mean, I bet these people are just lovely today. I've lost track of all of them. But, you know, these are the things I remember, funneling beer at a party. I mean, who does that? I went rafting on the Chattahoochee and got drunk, and I believe stoned, wrecked my car or hit a pothole on Roswell Road so that my tire and my wheel were smashed. And my aunt had given me that car, and she was not stupid, and she knew exactly what had happened. And I got a lecture to the all. But the drinking that summer got worse in the fall when we went back to school. And I was, so that fall quarter of 83 was when I was introduced to other substances. And I began to do quite a bit of experimentation. And that quarter, I was in classes that were way too elevated for me. They were accounting and economics and things that I had no business in. And so with the drinking and the drugging and the bad grades, my parents pulled me out. They'd had enough. They had seen me at home that summer, and they knew what I – in fact, Mother had allowed us to play quarters at the kitchen table in the breakfast room. I remember that. But she saw it and was none too impressed. So they pulled me out, and in 84, I started at Georgia State University. I did okay with that transition. It wasn't great, but because – I wasn't completely fulfilled. I got a job at Houston's down there by Lenox, if any, most of y'all are from Atlanta, and I hostessed. And that, of course, somewhere around 86 or 87, I got introduced to drugs. I'm going to try not to deal with it too much, but let's just say the white powder about pulled me down. And it was probably a couple of years that I did it. I sought it out. I hung out with people who did it. I nearly failed out of my senior of college, the senior year, my final quarter, and I majored in French. And I called Dr. Peterson one night. He had noticed a significant decline in my work, and somehow I got his home number and called him from a payphone. This is back in the day, and just told him that I was messed up and lost. And he knew from a friend of mine what the problem was. And so he let me retake a test that I had bombed, and he made a phone call to Dr. Georges Perlat, whose class I was failing. And by the grace of God, both of them passed me. I don't know if I deserved it or not, but they passed me. So I did graduate from Georgia State University. But I will say, despite that bad quarter, all of my grades were phenomenal. I was typically on the dean's list. Either all A's or two A's and a B, that quarter just took me down because of my extracurricular activities, pardon the pun. So I did graduate, but my behavior did not improve. I continued to do drugs and alcohol. So in February of 88, when I was 24, grandmother and Louise and mom and dad drove me to Ridgeview Institute and put me on a 30-day lockdown. I could not see that I had a problem. I thought this is what young people did. You go out to bars, you drink, do some drugs. I sat there through the whole 30 days, and all I remember about it is making sure I had cute outfits to put on, going in to eat. It was always fun because you could socialize with people. They had a gym there, and I loved to work out. I actually got in trouble for working out too much. They made me not run so fast and cut back on my exercise because they said that was a sign of addiction. But anyway, I was just writing it out because I knew I wasn't going to stop drinking. So this is where it gets kind of blurry. I don't remember all of the details, but I remember that at some point after I got out of treatment, this guy named Cleve and I got together one night, and I think we told my parents and his family that we were going to a movie, but we either lied or changed our minds, and we went to Macon on a drug run. he knew people down there. And I actually sold a family heirloom for illegal substances. And by the time that night was over, I was either too wasted or too scared because it was so late. I was scared to go home. So I called this other guy that I knew in treatment that I knew was not straight, named Tim, and I went to his house. Well, he had two roommates who were also men, and I ended up staying there for a month or two. I don't know how long. I don't remember. Mom and Dad begged me to come home, just begged me. Dad, they came over to the house, and I remember they were standing on the front porch asking me to come home, and Daddy was just crying, begging me to come home, just no questions asked, just get your stuff. And I wouldn't leave. They had, that guy, Tim, had gotten me a car to drive. He had taken me to the beach. We would go out at night and party. And I was like, I'm having fun. I have no desire to come home and take your wrath. So finally, though, Tim got back together with an old girlfriend. I got kicked out and had to go home. So I got caught drinking again. This time they put me in Peachburg for an outpatient program, and it was decided that I would live with grandmother and Lise. So, and I left out that while I was living with those guys, we were out one night on a run, shall we say, I met my soon-to-be husband. I approached him for substances. He got him medicine at another place, kept his number. So when I was living with grandmother and Louise, he and I were dating. I was in Peachford on the outpatient program. They would give you anti-abuse in the morning, and I would spit it out. And then I would drink with Patrick Sr., my soon-to-be husband, and I would steal grandmother's liquor. And Sassy, there, her sister lived in the duplex next door, and I would steal Sassy's wine and water it all down. Whatever I stole from grandmother was white, and I would water it down. And so they figured out what was going on, but they blamed it on Betty the maid. Had no idea I was doing that. The other thing that's horrible is during that period of time at Peachford, they would have meetings at night. Some kind of, I don't know, once a week, I guess we had to go to an AA meeting, and I would drink during those meetings. I would take alcohol with me. And I remember Wee's driving me to Nava, where we all go to meetings now. And I remember driving in the car next to her with one of those white liquors in my cup that I was drinking. And I went in Nava with alcohol, sat against the wall in the back, and just scoffed at the entire meeting. But so through this all, Patrick Sr. and I married in June of 1989. We drank daily. He played baseball and was out a lot at night, not only for baseball, but just drinking in bars. So I was at home a lot, and I drank at home. We were just terrible, just drinking daily to the point of oblivion. At some point in 1990, I remember that I quit drinking for a short period of time. During that period, he decided he wanted a divorce. No, it wasn't a divorce, but he wasn't happy being married. So I went and moved in with my parents and went back a few weeks later. And then and we got back together. And in 1992, my son was born, Patrick. So obviously, I didn't drink for the 9 or 10 months that I was pregnant with him. 1994 was the year of the three D's, death, divorce, and DUI. So what happened is, on my birthday, February 24th of 94, my 30th birthday, no less, I'm standing in the den talking to my husband. I'm sure we're both drinking, and I was holding Patrick Jr. when Senior announces he wants a divorce. So I stood there dumbfounded. Couldn't for the life of me imagine that it was because of all the nights I had passed out drunk and would scream ridiculous things and carry on and make his life miserable. But anyway, that was on my birthday in February. So this is another abandonment, and this is another one of those transitions that I did not handle well. The next month, March, Louise was diagnosed with cancer, a very aggressive form of lung cancer, and she died 6 months later. So I remember during that time period when she was dying, of course, I drank like a sailor. I just drank and drank and drank to drown it, the fact that she was going to die. But all that everyone would say is, what's going to happen to Eve and Mary without Louise? What's going to happen to Eve and Mary? And I have a lot of guilt because there was so much time that I could have gone to the hospital, or when she was home, I could have gone to stay with her and visit her. But instead, I chose to drink. So she died in October. In December, I got a DUI. I had gone to an office party. I was newly divorced, and I was an alcoholic. I went by myself. I didn't take a date, and the party was probably 20, 30 miles away from where I lived, way up in Marietta. I got lost coming home. And by the time I got back to my side of town, I guess it's what you would call broadsiding, but I literally was on Claremont Road, not a mile from Napa, and I hit a car and kept on going. I think they were stopped to turn left, and I hit them and kept on going, and I didn't even know what I had done, and drove 4 or 5 miles back to my house in Decatur where the blue lights flashed in my driveway. And the cop cuffed me, and I remember pleading with him, begging with him, can't you see I'm a nice person? I'm not a jail kind of girl. Can't you let me off? My God, if you put me in jail with those horrible people, what's going to happen to me? Look at these rings I'm wearing. I tried everything. And he basically just told me that because I had failed the sobriety tests and the ABCs and whatever all you have to do, that, and I had hit the people, that there was no way out. And he hated it, but he had to take me. He did. He walked me all the way through the thing until they book you or whatever. I think his name was Hank. But that was dreadful. But again, so Senior bails me out. We're divorced by now. And he comes. He's already had 3 DUIs, so he's the pro at this, right? So he bails me out. I still think it's all a joke. I don't get that this is serious. So I have probation and a fine and what I called very disrespectfully customer service instead of community service. And I had a temporary driver's license. So I did my probation. I paid my fine. My customer service or community service was at NABA. I served food downstairs for God knows how long. And I had that temporary driver's license. By the grace of God, I could drive to and from work. Well, I want you to know I stopped almost every day at the liquor store or the grocery store to make sure I had plenty of alcohol to drink. So the DUI ain't stopping me. I drank all through the 90s, and by this time it's just me and Patrick Jr. in the house. And I drank all through the 90s. I changed jobs, and I remember I quit drinking periodically late in 99, and then I quit in 2000, and I cannot remember exactly when, but it's important because I had one drink right before September 11th in 2001. Somebody asked me out on a date, and I couldn't remember ever having gone on a date without alcohol, so I got drunk to go out. That was the only time. I didn't go out with him again, and I didn't drink anymore until 2004. I was dating somebody at that point in time, and when I went to his house, once a week on Sundays, I would decide I could have one glass of wine. And sometimes it was 2, and I did that for a year. So I kidded myself into thinking, you got this. You can drink one drink a week, and you've already gone 3 years without drinking, and you haven't gotten drunk. You haven't had a problem until 2005. Somebody brought me a bottle of wine. So I had the whole bottle at my house, and I drank it all that night. Then I went on pretty much until July of 2008 to drink daily. There were a few exceptions. I would stop and only drink on the weekends. But a dear friend of mine who had moved to Indiana died suddenly. He fell down the stairs, hit his head, and died. And that was another transition I was not ready for. So I picked up daily drinking then. Finally, in July, on the 6th of 2008, I quit drinking. That was it for me. I'd had enough. I'd gone to the doctor, and my liver enzymes were elevated. My blood pressure was really high, and they thought something was wrong with my appendix. I had to have a series of MRIs on my liver, and I had just had it. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, so I stopped drinking. I never have wanted to drink since again. That was just it. So that was July of 2008. In November, I lost my job. November of 08, and this is about the time of the crash of the economy. So that meant, because I was in severe credit card debt, that I lost my, not only my job, but my house and my car, and I had no savings, and I would have been homeless if not for my parents. So they basically helped me kind of get on my feet again, and I started a pet sitting business. I'll spare you all the details. In 2010, I had a spiritual awakening. I was born again in church, and that saved my life. That really gave me some good perspective and helped me. But the problem was the fear was still there. I couldn't escape it, and it enabled me to get into this dreadful, very unhealthy relationship that lasted for 5 years. It was so bad that my family really wouldn't speak to me. I was excluded from every family party. Mom and Dad, I think, probably didn't even want to talk to me on the phone. But finally, something happened in about 2015. I called Mom, and I said, I feel scared. I feel panicky. I feel like I did when I was drinking. And I said, Mom, it's not that I want to drink, but it's that I feel that same old way. I cannot stand this feeling of fear that's overcome me. It was almost like an anxiety attack. And she said, Evie, I really wish you would go to AA and just get in the middle of the bed, as she called it. She said, because for me, it takes away all the fear. Well, that was all I needed to hear, and I went. And I went by myself to that same place where I had drunk and scoffed. And some of her friends that I had met through the years of going to give her chip met me and got me a place to sit. And I don't remember what that meeting was about, but I can tell you it just changed me. I felt an overwhelming peace, and it was wonderful. And because I worked the steps and I was so engaged and so ready for the program, it only took me a month to find a job. Within 5 months, I had ended that dreadful relationship. And actually, now all of my relationships are restored, all of them except one with my sister. It's probably 50-50. It may never be completely restored again, but I've done everything that I should do. I now have a new understanding of myself and of others. It gives me peace. I no longer need substances or codependent relationships. I feel like I'm happy, joyous, and free. You know, I found out that prior to AA, even without alcohol, for that 6.5 year period where I stayed sober without the program, I was selfish to the extreme. I was highly impulsive. I was quick to give my unsolicited opinion and highly critical and judgmental. And that's putting it mildly. But AA has softened me, and now I pause. If I get agitated or confused, I don't say the first thing that comes to my mind or criticize people. Letting God guide me has been the answer. It's been the missing ingredient, because even when I believed in God in church, I didn't understand how to let go. So the third step has helped me, and letting go and letting God has become my mantra, and I guess has just restored me to sanity. And with that, I think I'm through. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Eve. You are a miracle. So please share with Eve any questions or comments.
Oh, thank you, Eve. I love you so much.
Oh, I love you
thank
too.
Thank you for sharing your sweet self with us.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad it's done. I've never done it before, so I'm glad to have that done. And now I can polish it up and do a little bit better.
I don't know. I have absolutely no criticism whatsoever. Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
No polish needed.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Right.
Absolutely.
I really related to being in a big university. You know, I went to Michigan State, same thing. It was like a little city, and I was lost as can be. I do know that sensation. So that I really related. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. I'm so glad you were participating here. It was good to have you.
Good to see you share your story. Thank you.
Thank you, Eve. That was wonderful.
Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, I had some very similar experience as trying to graduate from Emory while drunk. Yeah. That last quarter after Dean's List. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know how that feels.
Not fun.
Love has got